Hello and welcome in.
First Science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. And when we hear about climate change, it's often doom, gloom, and the apocalypse is nigh. So I'm really excited to say that our show today brings you some exciting new research with a huge potential to counter global warming. Dr. Ian McDonald is an environmental scientist and senior program manager at the Qatar Carbonates and Carbon Storage Research Centre at Imperial College, a program which is revolutionising our ability to store carbon dioxide deep underground. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
I'm great, thanks.
Not too put off by the drizzle getting here.
I'm Scottish.
Very good point. Now, your work is often referred to kind of shorthand as carbon capture. And most of us on the team had never heard of it before we kind of found you. Is it relatively new research?
Yeah, so you haven't heard of it. That's one of the purposes of me coming and talking to you. But it is relatively new to you. But when we look at it from a technology point of view, it's relatively an old technology from the 70s. It was really first developed and commercialised at scale. It's only more recently become important because we are now seeing CO2 as a real waste that we're polluting the atmosphere with. We didn't look at that previously in that context, but so now we're actually looking at, we can't dump the CO2 in the atmosphere. We need to somehow deal with the CO2, and carbon capture is a way to do that.
I guess that back in the day, in the same way people used to just dump their sewage in rivers and let the planet deal with it, and now we're realising we have to sort out our own sewage before it can go in the river. It's the same kind of principle, isn't it?
Sure, it's cleaning up air quality and making sure our air is good to breathe. So it's not only about CO2, it's about all the particulates and all the other pollutants we discharge into the atmosphere, which a lot of conventions in the world, we've already tried to clean up from NOx and SOx, and now we're moving on to the carbon dioxide.
Fantastic. I can't wait to hear more. Joining me behind the desk today is our newest producer, Kira, and she has a brain teaser for you. Good morning, Kira.
Good morning. Why did carbon marry hydrogen?
That is the question. If you think you know the answer, you can tweet us at Soho Radio or at Science Mixtape, and Kira will be revealing the answer later in the show. I also want to say that for our experiment today, if you're hoping to take part, you are going to need to grab yourself a penguin chocolate bar, a dairy milk chocolate bar, and an Aero chocolate bar, as well as a glass of milk. So a pretty tasty experiment for you there today. I'm looking forward to that one. Now, Ian, it's your mixtape. What song have you picked first and why?
Well, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, pretty early, so I thought we'd need to do something to, you know, to respect the fact that it's morning. So as I'm a sort of a 90s, 80s kid, Oasis are a big part of my life. Therefore, I've had to choose Morning Glory.
Average temperatures have climbed 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit around the world since 1880. Much of this is in recent decades, according to NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all becoming so much more aware of climate change and carbon dioxide as an instigator of this. But you haven't always worked in carbon capture, have you, Ian?
No, originally I'm a marine scientist. I trained for marine biology, and I was working for my PhD on looking at the ecology and geology of coral reefs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Did you get to go diving and stuff?
Yeah, so that was my main reason for sort of going that way, as I wanted to really sort of have a career in diving. So that was a big driver. But then I sort of were working on the reefs and seeing how they were being degraded, particularly in some of the places that I managed to visit, and seeing really bad state of the coral reefs there. I sort of wanted to just think, well, we can either monitor these coral reefs dying, or we can, you know, actually do something about why they're dying. And one of the main reasons is the global warming and higher sea level, higher sea temperature.
Oh, so the coral actually die if the temperature gets too high in the sea?
Yeah, it's called coral bleaching. You may have heard of it. It's when all the corals basically just turn white.
Oh, yeah, I've seen pictures, and it just looks like kind of broken coral arms, yeah, and they're all white.
It just has this white skeleton look to it. There may well still be corals alive on those skeletons, but you just can't see them because the colour they have come from their symbiotic host, zooxanthellae, and they expel them when they're bleached because they're under stress. And so my idea, when I was younger, I wanted to do something else rather than just working on the corals. I wanted to somehow try and look at how we can stop the carbon dioxide, and that's how I really moved into working with industry and getting inside industry and working with them to sort of improve their processes. And that then led to the job at Imperial College, working on this industry-sponsored, one of the biggest projects Imperial has, funded by industry, and is working on CCS.
And so CCS stands for carbon something storage?
Carbon capture and storage. Yes.
Ah, yeah. Sorry. Carbon capture and storage. Okay, tell us a bit more about that. So in my head, you're just going to kind of like have some sort of material that reacts with carbon dioxide and sucks it out of the air. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah, we would generally look at large point sources of CO2, so a power station or an industrial source, and they have big stacks that emit all the gases, the waste gases they don't want.
Yeah, like out of a giant chimney.
Yeah, a giant chimney. And basically you put some technology onto that chimney that they can scrub the gas coming out and preferentially take the CO2. And so you just have the CO2 and that can be put into a pipeline.
And is it in a gas form?
Yeah, it's in a gas form, effectively. And we can compress it and ship it down through pipelines or in ships to where it wants to go. And then we take it to a certain place on the Earth where we've identified a decent reservoir, so a large amount of rock deep underground where we can put the CO2 into. And this rock is fairly substantial. It's not a big caves that we bump it into. So we inject it into these deep reservoirs.
Wait, so you're putting it into the actual rock, not like a space within the rock?
Yeah, so we put it into the pore space within the rock. The rock, quite substantial rock that could be used for building material, for example. The Royal School of Mines at Imperial was made out of Portland rock, and that rock we use in our scientific experiments to see how CO2 flows. So it's substantial rock, but this rock all has pore space in it. So lots of rock underneath our feet has all these tiny pore spaces in it that are generally filled with water. Occasionally they'll be filled with oil and gas, and that's where the oil and gas industry come in, because they come and drill into these reservoirs and suck out the oil and gas. This is, we're sort of doing the opposite. We're putting the CO2 back deep down into these reservoirs.
Amazing. Okay, and so when you're doing that, what are the kind of main challenges around putting the carbon dioxide into the rock?
Well, first of all, you've got to choose the right sort of rock. So you've got to do a lot of work in choosing your site selection and making sure that that rock is a good type to put it into. And then we've got to make sure that there's basically the four trapping mechanisms for making sure the CO2 is stuck down there. We've got to have to make sure that they are basically, all of them are present within this reservoir to a varying degree. It will change a lot per reservoir.
And what are those four trapping mechanisms?
So the first one is simple. When you're injecting CO2 into a reservoir, the CO2 will be more buoyant than the surrounding brine, the salty water in that rock. And so that CO2 will want to migrate up through the rock.
So it's going to travel up through the pores?
Up through the pores. And so what you don't want it to do is travel up to the surface of the seabed or to the surface of the land. Mm-hmm. And so what you need to make sure your reservoir has is a very good, what we call a cap rock or a seal. So these are very common in locations throughout the world, because this is exactly how oil and gas is trapped and why they form large reservoirs. This is a seal and a cap rock. It's a type of rock that doesn't allow flow effectively. So it's a real sort of like clay, muddy rock that doesn't have many holes, doesn't have many cracks through it. And so that's the type of rock we're looking for. And this will form the structural trapping of the CO2. And that's the first and sort of most important trapping mechanism that we must look for in a good reservoir. The other trapping mechanisms, one is called dissolution trapping. And this is effectively just like having fizzy water. So the water down there isn't fizzy. And what we're doing is we're injecting the CO2, and the CO2 will dissolve into the water and turn fizzy.
Amazing. That's so cool. So you're just like fizzifying all the water in the rock.
And with that, the structural trap will keep that under pressure. So it'll keep the CO2 dissolved in the water.
Right.
Of course, sometimes the brine down there is already fully saturated with various minerals, so we can't depend on that solely. Another trapping mechanism is called capillary trapping, or residual trapping. And this is a bit like when we inject the CO2 and it starts to flow up towards the cap rock, it leaves a large slug trail of CO2 that's trapped within these rocks. And not getting too much into the science and physics behind it all, but basically the CO2 will flow through the pore spaces, through these small pores that are connected by capillaries.
Mm-hmm.
These capillaries don't particularly want to let the CO2 flow through them, because the rock is what we call water wet. It's water loving. So the rock prefers to have water closer to it than the CO2. So the CO2 sort of pushed into the larger spaces.
Right.
And when there's a large volume of CO2, that's fine. The CO2 can flow. But once the volumes become smaller and this plume starts
then
to migrate,
then the water kind of like makes
water,
little pockets.
Yeah, it'll make little bubbles of CO2 that are trapped within the pore spaces.
And can't move.
And so that's really important. And we've managed to image that in our labs for the first time ever. And that's a really sort of important step forward to showing to people, you know, residual trapping is real. We can show you it now.
Wait, so you can see it like in an image?
Yeah, so we take special X-ray technology of the rocks and we flow the CO2 through, and then we pump lots of water through. And then at the end, you can see that we've got these bubbles of CO2 trapped within these tiny pore spaces in the rocks.
Great. And you said there were four, so what's the last way?
The last way. We don't particularly work on the last way because it's quite a long-term process. It's called mineralization. It's when the CO2 effectively turns into rock itself. And that requires several sort of key ions to be present in the brine solution. But it could take, you know, hundreds to thousands of years to happen.
Mm.
But CO2 storage is fairly much a permanent store. We don't really want to get that CO2 back. So we want it to become safer in the long term. And this is one of the processes that will help that happen in a much longer term. So you're...
Could it ever turn back to oil if it was like millennia?
Not really, no. CO2 is such a basic building block that to get to oil, it needs so much energy put into it and or other biological processes to happen that, yeah, that time frame isn't really possible.
What is your second song?
My second song is all about how CO2 can flow through the rocks, and it's Even Flow by Pearl Jam.
See what you've done there.
Last year, all the world's nations combined pumped nearly 38.2 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide into the air from the burning of fossil fuels such as coal and oil. That's about a billion tonnes more than the previous year. China, the US and India are the worst offenders.
Now, on to the part that I've been really excited about all morning. We are going to do our experiment. Ian, I've got a cup, I've got some milk and three different chocolate bars. Tell me what I should be doing.
Right, so this is to demonstrate to people about the rock types that we want to look for CO2 storage.
So the best kind of rocks, the ones with those pores that you talked about.
The ones, the pores. And it's not just the pores that are important, it's what we call the permeability. It's how well those pores are connected. So there are three chocolates. One represents our seal, our cap rock. One represents our reservoir. And one's a dummy one put in there to throw you off the scent.
Okay.
And so, yeah. So our dairy milk, well, I think it's fairly obvious, dairy milk's pretty solid chocolate, and so that's our cap rock. So the idea here, we have a glass of milk, and what the idea is, if you break open the chocolate bar and pour the milk into a glass for you.
Okay, pouring my milk in.
And then if we get the dairy milk bar and we open it up.
Okay, my dairy milk's ready to go.
And then break off each end of the dairy milk bar.
Okay.
So that we can see the actual inside of the chocolate bar. And then if you try and blow, put one end in your mouth and then the other end in the milk.
Like a giant chocolate straw.
Like a giant chocolate straw. Try and blow through that and you'll know that basically nothing happens. Okay?
Making a strange squeaking sound.
Yeah. And so actually you have carbon dioxide in your breath as well. So you're trying to blow through that, but nothing's flowing. Okay? You can't blow through.
The breath is not getting into the milk. No.
Yep. And so we want to do the same with the aero bar.
So that's our seal, and that shows that the CO2 doesn't flow through it, and that's the stuff that keeps it all in the ground.
Yep.
Okay.
And so the aero bar, now everyone knows aero bars quite well, that's why we use them, is the large pores. They've got lots and lots of holes, big, big pores. You can see them really easily. And so when we do with the kids, they all shout that this is the rock that's going to be the best for storing CO2.
Yeah, it looks great.
Most like our sandstones or our carbonate rocks that we work with. So you do the same thing, you break it off at each end, and if you try and blow through it, there should be
less squeaky, but there's still no bubbles.
Still no bubbles.
So that means that my breath's not travelling through it.
Yeah, right? you can't force gas through that chocolate.
No.
Okay. So the last one is the penguin bar.
Why are penguins good at driving racing cars?
And the bonus is we get the free joke. So you've got to bite off each end of the penguin bar this time.
Okay. Oh, I mean, what a terrible affliction. I have to eat penguin bar.
I know. This is why the kids particularly like this one when we go to public events and we get large queues forming up to taste the chocolate.
Okay.
So you get the penguin, you do the same with all the other chocolates. You put one end in the milk and one end in your mouth and you try and blow through it. And there you go. You can actually hear the bubbles coming through, so that's great.
Oh my God, there's loads of bubbles.
So what we have there is not only the pores, because the penguin bars has lots of tiny pores because it's a biscuit.
Yeah.
But all those pores are actually connected. So when you blow, you can actually, your breath will travel through all those pores to the other end.
Oh, wow. So the penguin bar represents the perfect rock.
Yes.
Wow.
And that's why penguins will help save the world.
Oh, I love it. And so is there just, in terms of like the perfect rock, is there one type? Does it have a name? Or are there quite a few that match the penguin bar?
Yeah, there are quite a few. There's the ones called sandstone rocks, which is predominantly what we have in the UK for storage.
Mm.
But our research centre itself works on what we call carbonate rocks, because we are funded by a country in the Middle East, and they're the ones who are really sort of have massive oil and gas reservoirs and these carbonate reservoirs. So again, they have these massive brine storage reservoirs potentially for use. So we're trying to help them resolve those issues of exactly what's going to happen to the CO2 on the ground.
And you've brought some rocks with you today. Can I have a look at them?
Yes. So first of all is a sandstone.
Now, listeners at home, you obviously can't see this, but as soon as Ian picked it up, the first thing I thought was, that's not rock, that's wood. It's a perfectly smooth cylinder, almost like it's been, and it's got kind of grainy pattern on it, so it looks almost like bark. But now that I'm holding it, it feels heavy, and it's got that kind of glinting sparkle that you get from sand.
Yeah, so the reason it's a cylinder is because we've actually cored that out of a much larger rock sample. So these are our sort of samples we put into our CT scanner for CO2 flooding.
The sort of thing that you image.
Yeah, this is what we sort of push the CO2 through and put in our special x-ray scanners.
And so do you go out to find these rocks with like a big machine, or how do you get these samples?
So these particular rocks actually come from what we call quarries. So basically they just quarry this stuff and we can buy some samples for that and then use them experimentally, and we sub-sample them in our labs. But another example I brought here is of the seal, or the sort of the cap rock. And so this one's slightly different. This is actually what we call an anhydrite. It's a massive amount of salt. So in the Middle East, these are some of the main seals. It almost looks like marble on that top surface.
Yeah, it does. It's shiny and it's got that kind of marbling.
So it's really, really dense. And it's very similar in properties for flow to a shale rock that we have more so in the UK.
And if I look, so obviously as a cylinder on the top, it's a perfectly flat circle. But if I look at the edges, I can see that the edge of the sandstone one is a little bit rougher. And this one is really, it's like a very clean line because it's so dense.
The one on the right has actually come from the subsurface. So that's come from over 1,000 metres deep down.
1,000 metres?
Yeah.
How is that deep for you guys, or is that a normal depth?
That's fairly normal depth. We want to get to those sorts of depth because we want the CO2 to be quite dense and stay dense.
So it needs to be under a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
How long does it take to drill that deep?
it can take many, many days to drill that deep.
Wow.
It's a very expensive thing to do.
Yeah. So you've got to make sure that you're choosing the right place.
Exactly.
There's a lot riding on it.
Site selection is critical.
What is your third song?
My third song is Bon Jovi and Living on a Prayer.
And why have you chosen this morning?
Because the human race is almost beginning to live on a prayer on how we're going to combat climate change.
Statoil's Sleipner plant in Norway is the world's oldest carbon storage project. It stores or injects carbon 1,000 metres below the seabed into a sandstone aquifer. It has been in operation since 1995.
So I do feel like that's quite new technology. If that's the oldest one and it's only been going 20-something years.
Yeah, that's the pure storage into saline aquifer. So there's another 20-plus years experience of actually putting the CO2 into depleted oil and gas reservoirs and getting more oil out, because the CO2 is a very good solvent. So it basically makes the CO2 want to basically move faster and move to the surface.
You mean it makes the oil want to move faster?
Yes, sorry. Yeah. It makes the oil more viscous and therefore come to the surface easier. And so when you use CO2, you can recover about 10% more from an oil reservoir than you can normally. Because when we look for oil, get to the reservoir, we generally only recover between 40 and 60% of the oil that's actually in that reservoir.
Oh,
we can't get all the
idea.
Oil out. It's the same principle as that capillary trappings, that oil gets trapped in the rock and it can't get out.
But if you can...
CO2, it lets that flow better and lets the oil be more mobilised.
This leads me really nicely onto my next question. Because you mentioned in passing that there are thousands of different uses for carbon or carbon dioxide. And so if we can trap it and take it out of the air, we can use it in all these different ways. Can you tell me more about that? I think that's so exciting.
Yeah, so that, you know, there are countless different ways we can use carbon dioxide. We can put it into greenhouses. So there's some plants in Holland that do that, take it from CO2 from an oil refinery.
Of course, because plants need CO2 to grow.
Yeah, so you put it in a greenhouse and they grow faster. And there's various chemical processes that take CO2 as a feedstock. So they need CO2 to make the chemicals or to help the chemical process go on. And therefore, they will have a demand for CO2, so we call it CCUS. The utilization is the U part, and certainly there's a big push going around the world to actually make use of this CO2. There are some major sort of drawbacks for this I have to sort of point out, and that is the amount of CO2 we produce globally vastly outweighs all the sort of end use products that we could possibly make with the CO2.
Right. Yeah.
So there's too much CO2 out there, so we still need storage massively. And one of the other drawbacks is a lot of time when we use the CO2, example is the tomatoes in the greenhouse, is we're not storing that CO2 away. That CO2 gets absorbed by the plant, and then either we eat the CO2 and we breathe out the CO2, or the plants rot and therefore they release the CO2. So it's not a permanent storage. It's only a short-term delay.
It's just that cycle of CO2, isn't it?
Yeah. And so we've got to really be looking at ways to lock out CO2 from the atmosphere.
And this really does have huge potential, though, doesn't it, for helping us to reduce our CO2 emissions globally?
Yeah, because one of the other mechanisms we can use is what we call BECCS, which is sort of bioenergy CCS. So we can grow crops that are principally, rather than for food, are actually for energy. So we wouldn't want to compete with growing crops in fields for food. We'd look at sort of the low yield areas of the world where we don't grow anything productive, or trees, for example, or large plants, and we can crop them and burn them for energy to produce, and then we actually capture the CO2 that they produce and then store that subsurface. And that's what we call negative emissions. And we get the CO2 levels in the atmosphere to actually start potentially to reduce.
That is so clever. So unlike the tomatoes where they rot and release their CO2, what you're saying is if we burn the trees that we've grown specifically for this, then they're not releasing their CO2 into the atmosphere because we're going to capture it and put it back underground.
Yeah.
That's so cool. So, I mean, what do you hope to see in the next kind of 5 to 10 years in terms of this technology and in terms of how it's being used?
Well, we've already demonstrated it, as was mentioned. And therefore, what we really need to see globally is a deployment. So various other plants around the world start to come online, start to be built. Other new technologies for capture to make it cheaper can be invented and sort of rolled out and commercialised. And also capturing the CO2 directly from the air. So there's a big push for direct air capture of CO2. So what I've been mainly talking about is capturing it from a flue stack, and that's maybe at between 4 and 14% CO2. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the atmosphere, we're at 400 ppm, which is about 0.04%,
yes,
much lower.
Much less.
So that's a lot harder to do. But there are plants around the world now that are looking at ways of directly air capturing the CO2.
And it's the UK. I mean, do all countries have carbon storage, or are we one of few countries that are kind of leading the way in this technology?
We're certainly one of the most advanced countries in respect of actually knowing what we have and quantifying it and looking for it. Most countries would have some CO2 storage potential, some not. But certainly the UK is very well blessed in CO2 storage. Largely anywhere that has a good oil and gas industry will have a very good CO2 storage potential.
Amazing. I just think it's so great to hear like a positive story about the climate change situation, because so much of it is so depressing. And to know that, like you said, when, you know, you can recycle, you can not eat meat, you can cycle everywhere. But those are all really small actions compared to knowing that industries are churning out hundreds and hundreds of tons of emissions every year.
And it's not just industry that CCS can help with, it's the transport. So we're talking about electric cars. If you have an electric car powered by a power station that has CCS, then it's low carbon. And also home heating is a major thing we need to decarbonize. And home heating in the future might come from us, instead of burning methane as we do now, so it's a large greenhouse gas pollutant, we might be burning hydrogen in the future.
Okay.
And two ways to get hydrogen. One is very green and using renewables to get hydrogen from seawater. And another way is to get hydrogen from methane. That gives you very pure CO2. You split it and you get the hydrogen and you get very pure CO2 that, again, then we go and store subsurface, but you are then burning hydrogen, which is a very clean burning fuel.
So it can reinforce other renewables or the ways that we create other forms of energy.
Yeah, it's certainly, CCS is not the only answer. I'm not saying that. We need to use renewables as much as possible, and we need to have energy efficiency, and there's lots of different slices to the cake. CCS is just one of those slices, and we've all got to work hand in hand.
I agree so much. Your fourth song.
Well, with respect to the direct air capture and the artificial trees sort of developments, it's...
Wait, not artificial trees? Tell me more.
I just mentioned that about we want to capture the air
from
CO2
the air,
from the air directly.
Yeah.
Yes, a big fan suck in and we blast it through membranes or various other materials that capture the CO2 directly from the air, so at 400 ppm, and deliver a very pure stream of CO2. So my song for that is, because it's one of the terms for it is artificial trees, is Radiohead's Fake Plastic Trees.
The green plastic watering can for a fake Chinese rubber plant and a fake plastic girl. She bought from a rubber man in a town full of rubber plants to get rid of herself.
Last year, the European Union government ordered its member countries to invent their own rules for CCS within the next 2 years. Individual countries must select storage sites and come up with standards for monitoring, safety and finance structures.
Science. News
just in. Are we sitting on a nitrate time bomb?
The UK government suggests a Green Britain Week.
Artificial cells can now produce insulin.
Butterfly child is given life-saving skin.
Corals like to eat plastic.
What's the impact of global warming on the Greenland ice sheet?
Quite a good varied selection of titles there. Kira, straight away, please tell me about these artificial cells producing insulin.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So scientists in the University of North Carolina have been trying to treat diabetes. So they've made these artificial cells, which essentially mimic the pancreatic beta cells. So they contain vesicles in them, which can detect blood levels or blood sugar levels. And when the levels get too high, they start secreting insulin.
Wow.
Yeah, so it could be like a
And they just put the cells into someone's body.
So they've only been tested on mice so far,
but that's like the idea,
the
eventually.
End goal, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. It'd be like getting a new pancreas almost.
Yeah, exactly.
Ian, coral likes to eat plastic. This sounds great. The coral reefs can clean up the ocean for us.
Unfortunately no, because they don't get anything from eating the plastic. But yeah, they've done some experiments where they basically looked at how the coral sort of sees a sand grain and sort of sometimes ingests it, only about 10% of the time, but generally will throw it away, because coral is actually an animal, it's not a plant. It has a plant within it. It sort of uses a symbiotic
like an algae, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it has that as a sort of symbiotic host. It's the host for this symbiotic zooxanthellae, which is the plant, but it itself is an animal, so it will generally eat. It will use its tentacles to grab stuff and bring it into its mouth and digest them. And so it's trying to do that with the plastic. It really likes the taste of plastic, it seems. It's tried to about 90% of the plastic pellets were offered to these polyps. The coral, I would actually eat them and try and ingest them, but it doesn't really get anything from them. And so it's just to go along the theme of the worldwide, where we have a real plastic issue in the oceans. It's been a lot of publicity. You might have seen it. And one of the interesting things is people try to clean up the oceans of the plastic. But one of the interesting other facts is that about 90% of all this plastic comes from about 10 rivers in the world. So what we should be doing is looking at those 10 rivers and having action plans for them to tidy them up, stop them ejecting all the plastics into the ocean.
That's crazy. Wow. So one of the stories that really caught my eye this morning was this butterfly child given life-saving skin. He's called a butterfly child because he has a rare genetic disease called junctional epidermolysis bullosa, and that leaves his skin as fragile as a butterfly's wings. So you can imagine anything that touches it is going to damage it. And incredibly, what's happened is a piece of his skin was taken. Its DNA was then repaired in a laboratory to remove the gene that was causing this butterfly condition, and the new skin was grafted back onto his body. It's taken 2 years for it to grow, but it now appears completely normal, and he no longer has that condition, which I just think
it's amazing.
Is really cool. Kira, tell me more about Greenland.
So during the last ice age, there was a sheet of ice that covered North America called the Cordilleran ice sheet. And this had a similar mass to the Greenland ice sheet. And when it melted, it caused a 20-foot rise in the sea levels and huge changes to the sea temperature and circulation. And scientists in the Purdue University in Canada used beryllium-10 measurements to track moraines, which are rocks and debris left behind after glaciers, to calculate when and how fast this Cordilleran ice sheet melted over North America. And they reckon that it only took 500 years for it to reduce by half its mass, and this could have a very similar result for Greenland as well. They think that it could decrease in 500 years.
Whoa. And then the sea level would rise 20 feet.
Yeah.
And we'd all get a lot colder.
Quite scary.
That's terrifying.
Yeah.
Let's hope this carbon storage works.
Exactly.
It does work.
Ian, what is Green Week? I'm intrigued.
Yeah, so the UK government recently released their clean growth strategy, which was a long time in coming. So all of us sort of energy people were really excited about it. And one part of it was actually, it's not had too much press coverage, is about they want to have 1 week in the year where basically everyone sort of focuses on the green issues and environmental issues. And so this is going to be a government-led initiative. I'm just hoping it's not going to go the same way as the Big Society, which sort of died a death after about 6 months. So it's really important because it would allow the ENGOs, environmental, non-government organisations to sort of sit there with the other big sort of potentially the polluters, the oil and gas industry and big industries and academics all sit around the same table and discuss things. Because a lot of the time we just talk to our own friends and talk within our own little bubbles. So it's really important to get out of our own bubble and talk to different people.
And I think so often in government as well, they just focus on short-term issues. Well, I mean, not, but like a lot of the time, and green and climate change, they're so big and they yes. require such long-term planning that when you're trying to get re-elected in 4 years, it's not top of your agenda. So it's good to hear that hopefully it will be moving up the agenda.
Hopefully.
And then my other story was, again, not the most positive one this time. Just not carbon, but nitrate could also be a problem. We apparently, according to a study, are sitting on huge quantities of nitrate chemicals from fertilisers, which are polluting the rocks beneath our feet. So I quite like this because it's also about a chemical being stored in rocks, but this time not intentionally. And what the researchers at the British Geological Survey are saying is that this nitrate could be released into the rivers and water supplies and really harm kind of human health and our economy, causing toxic algal blooms and fish deaths. And I think we've heard about this kind of on small scale, but with so much of it now being in the rocks, they think 180 million tonnes of nitrate are stored in the rocks worldwide, twice the amount that's stored in soils, and that over time that is going to seep into our waters. I think it's kind of like a long-term process. So in the small amount of time that we've been using fertilisers, it's been building up and building up and building up, and it's only just starting to kind of seep back out. Yeah, so one
quite
to watch.
Scary again.
Yeah, we're doing the doom and gloom. Let's yeah. move on to something brighter and happier. Ian, your fifth song.
My fifth song. Well, it's to generally represent the fact that we can't have all of our eggs in one basket. So harking back to my Manchester days, it's Fool's Gold by the Stone Roses.
I'm really interested in exactly kind of what your research and your research group involves. So we've talked about how you have a scanner and you're looking at how carbon dioxide behaves in the rocks, but tell me more.
Yeah, so we've got a lot of experimental people working. So we've got about 45 PhDs in total and about 40 postdocs.
Wow, that's a big group.
It's a big group, and about half of them are experimental, so doing things like looking at with x-rays at how the rock and fluids are interacting, but also how fluid and fluids are interacting at different temperatures and pressures. And the other half form a really important component, and when we actually just try and model the processes. So currently we have models and
like computer models.
Yeah, computer models and simulations. And so we're trying to understand and predict what will happen when we inject CO2 underground. And currently we use a lot of technology from the oil and gas industry that hasn't been bespokely designed for CO2 or calibrated for CO2. And therefore, you know, that's what current industry standard is. And it works to a degree. But there's some unknowns and some things that we want to really validate. You know, should these models be using this data? If we don't have any experimental data, then we need to provide that experimental data to make sure that the models are actually ground truth properly.
Because it could be like the weather, where your models are never, ever quite that accurate.
Well, yeah, no model is ever 100% accurate, is it? That's the why it's a model.
And like we said, drilling 1,000 meters is super expensive, and you want to make sure that your carbon is going to stay underground for years.
Yeah, for millennia. So you really want to stay down there, and you don't want it to react with the surrounding rocks. You don't want it to move into an area where, say, another someone else owns. So you've got all these properties about pore space and how the actual CO2 will move and interact with all the stuff around it, whether it's other fluids or rock.
Is there anything that's really surprised you in your time looking at this?
We've made some pretty interesting discoveries and scientific advancements. And of course, as typical academics, we sort of try and answer one question, but we come back with about 15 other ones. So we've looked at some interesting processes to do with flow. And without getting too technical, we've sort of indicated how we currently think that flow works at a very small scale and pore scale. isn't actually what happens according to our experiments. So we're some of the first people to actually look into the rocks and actually see inside these rocks using our X-rays. And we expect to see one thing, which is what all current understanding and models are based on, and we're not seeing that. So we're needing to go back to the drawing board and sort of evaluate that and think, how does that have an implication on the bigger scale and the much more larger reservoir scales? Just help to improve our predictions, basically.
Has there ever been a situation where carbon has escaped from a storage site?
Not to my knowledge, not without it being intentional. So when we have CO2 EOR, the CO2 comes back sometimes with the oil and they recirculate that.
Oh yeah, but when you said they pump it through, they know that's going to happen.
So they know that's going to happen. There have been a few cases when, because the oil and gas industry sort of know how to monitor the reservoirs. And so you know when things could potentially start to be going wrong. And that's when you stop injecting CO2 and you start to assess, well, why aren't our models correct? Why hasn't the reservoir behaved like we thought it would be? And that's why we need to do more and more CO2 storage projects now, so we can improve that understanding through deployment.
So you might have a situation where you can't store as much as you thought because you're getting warning signs, but it still hasn't actually kind of escaped.
It wouldn't have escaped, no. Hopefully not. There are a few potential escape paths, and generally we try to get rid of them during the site selection process. And the biggest risk per se would be actually for the CO2 to come back up the well bore. So the place where we're injecting it down into.
Where you drill.
Yeah, where we drilled is basically one of the biggest risks of it coming back in you. And so, again, oil and gas processes sort of know how to stop that from happening. And we'd apply that technology to CO2 storage.
Is there ever a danger that we will run out of space? Or is this like a really good long-term solution for have we got kind of infinite reservoirs?
I mean, yeah, it can't be infinite. But. It's not really infinite, but we have the reservoir subsurface. They're so large, we don't really understand. Joe Public doesn't really get how big these reservoirs are that are down there, because the oil and gas only occur in the small pockets of these massive reservoirs, and all that other reservoir space can be used for CO2 storage effectively. And they're around the world, all over the world. The UK is very well blessed. We've assessed them. The royal we has assessed it. And we have enough storage here. And we could actually start storing CO2 for mainland Europe as well.
What, here in the UK?
In the UK. And Norway has the same idea, and so does Holland.
Maybe that'll be our industry that saved us in Brexit.
Well, it could well be. So those three countries are really sort of trying to champion and forward the idea of being a CO2 hub, taking CO2 from other countries and storing in their reservoirs.
While we're talking about sort of field work and your research in detail, there's a little feature that we like to do here on Science Mixtape called the Fieldwork Faux Pas. Do you have any stories from your research that of anything going a bit wrong? Because, you know, scientists are only human.
Yeah, so I have to hark back to quite a long time ago when I was diving in Jamaica with my colleague. And we were trying to collect some sediment samples for her PhD, because as diving, you sort of had to go with buddies and you have to basically help someone out to do their stuff and they help you do yours.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We were working on her field site, one of the best diving locations in Jamaica. And we were collecting sediment samples. And to do that, we basically have them in a pot and then you put them in a goodie bag and you sort of carry that along with you as you're collecting all your samples. And we were also looking for dead coral and collecting dead coral, because she was studying what was growing on and in the coral. And so to do that, you had to wear gloves, because sometimes you can get sponges on them that can hurt your fingers. And so you just typically had marigold. So there's nothing fancy when it comes to doing a PhD in coral reefs. Everything's very low budget. And at the end of the dive, we were getting ready to surface. And then we realized that she'd lost her goodie bag. So all the sediment samples and the coral had gone. And we sort of had a quick look around. We couldn't find it. You're breathing compressed air, so you've only got limited time down there. So we had to surface. So we came to the surface, and then about 25 meters away, we saw the goodie bag floating, and the marigold had got some air into it. So it'd obviously been basically buoyant and floated to the surface. But the air in the marigold had managed to make one of the fingers in the marigold stand up, and the rest of the fingers weren't. And guess which finger that was?
Oh.
So it was sort of bobbing away in the sea with his one finger up pointing at us. And we're thinking, right, we've got to swim to get it. And as we swam over, we got to about 5 meters away. And of course, the bag and the marigold separated and the bag fell down to the deep depths. And the marigold was just rather sat there floating. So we were a bit gutted that an entire dive had been ruined by this finger pointing.
F-U marigold. That's a fantastic story to end on. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating.
You're very welcome.
Before we go, we need the answer to Kira's brain teaser. Have you had any thoughts of why carbon married hydrogen?
I'm sorry, that's a proper penguin joke. Go ahead and tell us.
Good answers to why carbon married hydrogen this morning, but the reason was because they bonded well from the moment they met.
Oh,
how cute.
That's wonderful. Finally, Ian, what is your final song to play us out on?
Well, this is just to sort of indicate that, yeah, climate change is a big issue and we don't have much time to react. And as I've played Bon Jovi earlier, I have to play, given I'm an 80s youngster, Europe, and it's a final countdown.
Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider. Or join us live every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Soho Radio, recently voted the best online radio station in the world.